Safe. Dennis Enberg should be alive. Garrett Wright and whatever other madman is playing this game with him should be stopped forever. Is that why you left the city? He was close enough that the scent of her perfume caught his nose and drew his head down. The nape of her neck was no more than a breath away. Tempting. Too tempting. He wanted her, and knew better than to give in to that seductive need. She was part of the story. The story was what he had come here for, to bury himself in it, to lose himself in it, to run away from his own pain and dissect someone else's. The reminder brought a bitter taste of self-loathing. The anger made him cruel. "Is that why you left, Ellen? Because you didn't want to fight this kind of fight? Is that what you ran from?" She wheeled on him, and he caught hold of her arms before she could slap him. "I didn't run from anything." "You were on the short list of up-and-comers in Minneapolis," he said, deliberately goading her. "Then suddenly you're riding roughshod over drunks and losers in Mayberry."
"I walked away. I wanted a saner life. I made a choice, and I certainly don't have to justify it to you."
"There's sure as hell nothing sane about what's going on here now," he growled. Ellen didn't know if he meant the case, or the heat building between them at that moment. He was too close, his hands too tight on her upper arms, his mouth just inches from hers.
"Let go of me,"
she ordered, jerking out of his grasp. The hall door swung open, and Henry Forster, a longtime reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, stepped in. Through the perpetually smudged lenses of his thick bifocals, his gaze hit Ellen with full magnified force.
"Ellen, are we going to get a comment from you?" he barked. "Or are we just supposed to draw our own conclusions?"
"I'm coming right now," she said.
Not sparing Jay so much as a glance, she picked up her briefcase and walked out. He followed at a distance, waiting for her to capture the full attention of the reporters before he slipped into the hall. The wait also gave him a moment to clear his brain. Damn. But he had got his balls in a vice this time. This was what he got for sniffing around a live case. Ordinarily, he had sense enough to come in after the fact, after the strongest of the immediate emotions had faded away, and the parties involved had gained perspective on the crime that had touched their lives. There was no perspective here. This case was as hot as a live wire, and just as dangerous. Scuttlebutt had the body of Dennis Enberg being hauled away for a look-see by a medical examiner. Ellen had as much as said she believed the lawyer had been murdered, even though the official rumor was suicide. Jay had heard the calls on the police scanner, had found his way to the Southtown shopping center, and bided his time in the relative warmth of his vehicle until the reporters lost interest in the scene and split in search of quotable sources. A single uniformed cop had been left to guard duty in front of the building. Jay had wandered up, bummed a cigarette, stayed to chat as if he had nothing better to do with his time. The cop, young and unaccustomed to the sight of gruesome death, had eventually let the details of the scene come rolling out. His hands shook so violently he could barely bring his cigarette to his lips.
"Man, I mean, you see things like that in the movies, but this was real,"
the kid mumbled. Far across the way, half a dozen cars were parked in front of Snyder's Drug. People came to buy cold tablets and headache remedies, ignorant of the fact that 100 yards from them, a man had had his brain splattered all over the wall of his office.
"It's a tough sight to stomach," Jay said. "Truth to tell, I've seen many a strong man toss his cookies right there and then, and there's no shame in it, if you ask me. Sight like that ought to make any decent person sick."
"Well, it did me," the kid admitted.
He looked at Jay out the corner of his eye.
"I suppose you've seen a lot. I read Twist of Fate. That was grisly."
"True enough. Never ceases to amaze me the violence people will do to one another."
"Yeah."
He sucked his Winston down to the filter, the ash glowing red as he tossed the butt. The look in his eyes was far away, deep inside, where people keep their darkest fears and seldom look at them.
"I can't imagine sticking a shotgun in somebody's mouth and pulling the trigger."
Murder.
as if this case hadn't been sinister enough to begin with. Jay now shot a sweeping glance across the crowd gathered for Ellen's impromptu press conference. The old warhorse with the beetle brows and bad comb-over, who had walked in on them, shouted down his colleagues.
"Ms. North, what is your reaction to Garrett Wright's release pending payment of bond?"
"It goes without saying, I'm extremely disappointed." She was all cool control once again, as if those moments of discomposure in the courtroom had never happened. However, Judge Grabko listened to both sides and made his decision, and we'll live with it. That's the way our system works. Which was essentially saying it hadn't worked this time. "Will Dr. Wright return to his home in the Lakeside neighborhood, virtually yards away from the Kirkwood home?" "I don't know," Ellen said. "I hope not. For the family's sake. What about the rumors that Dennis Enberg's body was transported to the Hennepin County Medical Center for an autopsy?" "Mr. Enberg died a violent and unexpected death. The city and county agencies are obligated to investigate that death to determine beyond question whether or not it was self-inflicted."
"Was there a suicide note?"
"No comment. With Garrett Wright in jail at the time, you can't possibly suspect involvement on his part in either Mr. Enberg's death or the kidnapping of Dustin Holloman, can you?"
"I have no comment regarding ongoing investigations." The stone wall had gone up. She had made her point about Wright's release. The rest would be for show. The tough lady prosecutor showing the world this small defeat didn't faze her. None of these reporters had seen her tears or heard the self-castigation in her voice. Jay had. And that mattered to him in a way that was patently unwise. He pulled his gaze off her and continued to scan the crowd. Courthouse personnel hung around the fringes of the media group, curious to see their allegedly ambitious assistant county attorney in action. Until the first kidnapping, press conferences had likely been a rarity here. A flash of rusty red hair caught his eye. He moved slowly down the hall, skirting the crowd, like a hunter easing up on wary prey. Todd Childs had focused his attention on Ellen, his gaze flat and cold behind retro-look glasses. He stood half-hidden by a marble column, wearing a long, olive-drab wool coat that looked as if it had been fending off moths in someone's attic for years. A student of Wright's at Harris. Childs had been mentioned in the news reports following the O'Malley incident on Saturday. One of the local TV stations had included a shot of him and a comment as to Dr. Wright's innocence in their follow-up story on Sunday. Jay eased up beside him, tipping his head conspiratorially.
"She's a cool one, isn't she?"
he murmured.
"She's a bitch,"
Childs said between clenched teeth. He jerked his gaze away from Ellen, looking at Jay as if he felt he had been tricked into responding.
"You a reporter?"
"Me? Nah. Just interested. How about you?"
He scratched his scruffy goatee and sniffed.
"Yeah, I'm interested. Dr. Wright is sort of a mentor of mine. The man is fucking brilliant."
"Yeah, but is he guilty?"
Childs glared down at him, pale skin tightening over his bony face. Even though the light in this part of the hall was poor, his pupils were black pinpoints, suggesting he had indulged in some substance other than the dope he smoked, the smell of which had become as ingrained in his ratty coat as the scent of mothballs.
"The man is fucking brilliant," he said again, enunciating each word crisply. "The case against him is bullshit."
He cut a nasty glance toward Ellen. "She'll wish she'd never started this." He backed away from the pillar and turned toward the steps at the far end of the hall. The sudden mix of voices, talking all at once, told Jay the press conference was over. He didn't look for Ellen, but fell in step behind Todd Childs. Keeping his head down, he hustled down the first set of stairs, coming even with Childs on the second floor landing.
"So are you involved with the protest out front?"
he asked, as they made their way toward the ground floor.
"Yeah."
Childs shot him a sideways look. "You ask a lot of questions. Who are you?"
"James Butler,"
he lied without hesitation.
"I'm doing some independent consulting work with the county auditor's office. You might have guessed I'm not from around here. I just sort of dropped in on all of this. Like tuning into the middle of a movie, you know?"
"Yeah, well, You know what they say, man? Childs muttered as he flipped down his clip-on shades. Truth is stranger than fiction. He pushed through one of the heavy main doors and cut diagonally down the steps, his bushy hair bouncing like a foxtail down the center of his back. Jay watched from the door, his sixth sense stirring restlessly.
Hey! A voice sounded beside him. You're Jay Butler Brooks! Adam Slater, Grand Forks Herald. Could I ask you a couple of questions?
Yeah, sure. Jay mumbled resignedly. His eyes remained on Todd Childs, who approached the small crowd of student protesters now celebrating his mentor's release, and walked right past them, as if they weren't there. Chapter 16. The news of Garrett Wright's release on bond swept through Deer Lake and onto Campion like a blizzard wind. Telephones at the courthouse and law enforcement center were jammed with irate calls from the faction of the population who believed Wright was guilty. In Campion, the search for Dustin Holloman went on unrewarded, and the reporters lost interest in shooting still more footage of grim-faced volunteers trudging through the snow. Word that Anthony Costello would be giving a formal statement in front of the Park County Courthouse about Wright's release sent them packing. The sidewalk in front of the courthouse took on the carnival atmosphere of a political campaign riding the tide of victory. The Harris College students who had been protesting Dr. Wright's incarceration took up new celebratory chants. The sci-fi cowboys, freed by a teacher in service day in the metropolitan school system, had set up a vendor's cart on the sidewalk and were selling t-shirts to raise money for Wright's defense fund. A boombox blasted out rap music with strong themes of injustice and oppression. Deer Lake natives watched the festivities with wary eyes from the front window of the Scandia House Cafe. In typical rural Minnesota fashion, all overt displays of emotion were considered suspicious. Ellen looked down on the goings-on from the window of the conference room. Momentum was swinging Wright's way. Just days ago, she had held the control. Now, her handhold was being pried away one finger at a time.
"Do you think they have a permit to sell those T-shirts?" Cameron asked.
"They do," Phoebe said, holding her glasses on her button nose as she looked down. "I checked, and we can't stop Mr. Costello from speaking on the steps of the courthouse, either."
"He would only use it against us if we tried," Ellen muttered. She turned away from the window and faced her team. Mitch had seated himself at one end of the table. Steiger positioned himself at the opposite end, standing with one dirty boot planted on the seat of the chair. Wilhelm sat halfway between them, looking shell-shocked, glassy-eyed. The idiot grin he had worn to Deer Lake a week ago had slipped badly in the last few days. Between developments in the Kirkwood case, the Holloman kidnapping, and Denny Enberg's death, the hours had been hellish, the pressure immense, the leads non-existent. "I'm familiar with Costello's tactics," Ellen said. "He believes the best defense is a good offense. He'll do everything he can to make us look bad."
"You mean he'll throw as much shit as he can at the wall and hope some of it sticks?"
the sheriff said bluntly. "I'm sure he wouldn't put it quite that way, but that's the gist of it. He plays big league hardball."
"He's an out-of-town stiff," Steiger snorted. "Just because he's from the cities, we're all supposed to crap our pants at the sight of him. He's just another shyster lawyer."
Cameron rolled his eyes. Phoebe gave the sheriff a look that suggested he smelled as if he had already seen Costello and fulfilled his statement. "This shyster is like having a great white shark land in our lake, Sheriff," Ellen said. "Do not underestimate him."
"He's got his own private investigator," Mitch interjected. "Raymond York. The guy was sniffing around St. Alicia's today. Father Tom called to complain."
Steiger scowled at him.
"So? So this P.I. will be working full-time to find anything that might get Wright off the hook, while the rest of us are trying to work this case, find Dustin Holloman, figure out whether or not Denny Enberg killed himself, and deal with our everybody garden-variety mopes."
"The Holloman case and Denny's death complicate our situation," Ellen admitted. "But if we go on the assumption they're tied to Josh Kirkwood's case, that it's Wright's accomplice carrying on the game, then we're still focused on nailing Wright." That could be a dangerous assumption if it's wrong, Wilhelm stated.
But it's not wrong, Mitch said. We know the kidnappings are related. The thing we can't be sure of is Enberg. The autopsy is scheduled for Monday. If we're lucky, we'll get the word on fingerprints Monday as well.
Did Denny's secretary know anything about any late-night appointments? Ellen asked. He shook his head.
She said it was a light day. 3 appointments with clients and a couple of reporters dropping by for comments. He didn't have anything scheduled after 5. Told her he was going to stay late and do some paperwork. I've got guys talking to the clients, trying to get a handle on his state of mind. Barb, the secretary, said he was down about the Wright case, but that he didn't want to talk to her about it.
No witnesses from around the shopping center? Cameron asked, tapping the end of his fountain pen against his legal pad, impatient for a break.
None yet, but we haven't been able to track down the night staff from the donut hut. They're gone to Mankato for the day, skiing.
Well, we know one thing, Wilhelm said. Wright didn't kill him. He was still sitting in jail at the time.
Grabko remedied that situation, Mitch muttered.
It may actually work to our advantage, to have Wright out on bail, Cameron offered. If we can put him under surveillance, he could lead us to the accomplice, to Dustin Holloman, tie the whole mess up in a nice, neat bow.
Somehow, I don't think he'll be that obliging, Mitch said. But I've already assigned a plainclothes detail to him, in case there's a god after all.
I've assigned an agent to the surveillance team, too, Marty Wilhelm said, without enthusiasm. I'm assuming nothing has turned up from the search of Wright's home? Ellen asked.
He shook his head. Nothing at all out of the ordinary. You might think he's an innocent man.
Mitch gave him a look that could have frozen fire.
I don't think he's an innocent man, Agent Wilhelm. Neither does your predecessor. And you had damn well better not think he's innocent either.
Hey, I've got an ongoing situation in Campion.
Garrett Wright is an ongoing situation,
Ellen stated sharply, pulling Wilhelm's attention back to her. We've got a probable cause hearing in less than a week, and a judge who has innocent until proven guilty embroidered on his underwear. I need every scrap of ammunition I can get to nail Wright. Costello fired his first shot today. He's going to try to get the arrest thrown out.
Fuck him! Mitch jumped to his feet. That was a righteous bust!
Ellen held up a hand.
I said he would try. He won't succeed if we have anything to say about it. I don't believe he'll convince Grabko, but in the meantime he'll be feeding his theories to the press, tainting the jury pool.
God damn weasel! Steiger muttered. Ellen turned to Wilhelm again. Tell me you've got someone working with the computer equipment you confiscated from Wright's home.
Yes, but they're not going to find anything. We all know that.
The notes from Josh's and Dustin Holloman's kidnappings were computer-generated and printed on a laser printer. Garrett Wright owns a laser printer.
But the thing doesn't have a memory. There's no way to tell if the notes came from that printer, Wilhelm argued. And so far, we haven't found a computer diskette labeled terroristic threats and creepy poetry.
Wright isn't stupid enough to have hung on to anything incriminating.
Mitch glared at him. Well, you would know more about stupidity than the rest of us, Wilhelm. But I know this. Guys like Wright get cocky. And when they get cocky, they get careless.
He told Megan they had done this sort of thing before, Ellen said. He told her they had committed murder. If that's true, then he has to have left a trail somewhere. And if he's proud of his accomplishments, I can't believe he hasn't kept some sort of souvenirs. No luck on the search for another property in the area?
Steiger shook his head. Not in Wright's name, not in his wife's name, nothing for priest or child's.
She looked to Wilhelm. You haven't found anything in his background? Wilhelm dug through a messy file folder on the table in front of him and tugged out a typed report.
He was a Boy Scout.
Cameron took the papers.
Any merit badges for cruel and unusual behavior?
I've read the report, Wilhelm said.
There's nothing out of the ordinary. His parents split up when he was a kid. He was raised by his mother, an office manager for a shoe factory in Mishawaka, Indiana, National Honor Society in high school, graduated with honors from Ball State, went on for his master's and doctorate at Ohio State.
He recited the history in a bored monotone,
surreptitiously checking his watch. He came here from the University of Virginia, and before that, Penn State.
He gets around for someone in a profession where tenure is the big brass ring, Cameron said.
Have you checked with NCIC? Ellen asked. They can scan their database for similar crimes in other parts of the country.
The man has no record, Ms. North.
All that means is he's never been caught, Mitch said. He began to pace. Jesus Christ, Wilhelm, if you don't want to do the job, fucking delegate. I'll call NCIC myself.
Wilhelm scowled at the table, color splashing across his cheekbones.
I'm doing my job, Chief Holt. I can't do everything at once.
I'm beginning to wonder if you can manage to walk and chew gum at the same time.
Time out! Ellen shouted, rising from her chair.
The men looked at her with surprise and annoyance for interrupting their argument.
We've got a case to make. You guys tear each other's throats out on your own time.
This is pointless, Steiger grumbled, waving a hand at them.
Before he could take his foot off the chair, a beeper went off. Everyone but Phoebe reached for a pager.
It's mine, Steiger said, reaching for the phone on the table.
Tension crackled like static in the air as he punched in the number and waited. No one spoke. Ellen knew that they were all thinking the same thing, that they were all thinking the worst and hoping for the best.
Steiger!
The sheriff barked. A muscle ticked in his cheek, marking time as he took in the news. 4 seconds. 5 seconds. Air hissed out between his teeth, taking his color with it.
Shit. Keep it quiet. Don't do anything. I'll be right there.
He slammed the receiver down.
That was Campion. They found the boy's boot with a note inside. Evil comes to him who searches for it.
The three cops grabbed their coats and headed for the door, grim-faced and silent.
I'll be there as soon as I can, Ellen promised.
Cameron closed the door behind them and clamped his hands on top of his head.
Shit! Shit, shit, shit!
Phoebe shoved her glasses up into her hair and covered her eyes with her fingers. Ellen sank back down on her chair.
Look at the timing, she said,
her gaze catching Cameron's. Just as Costello was about to start his press conference with Garrett Wright standing beside him, a clue is found in an identical case 20 miles away.
You think Costello knows?
Tony had shown his colors before, but could he be that cold, that ruthless? Could he know the name of the person who held the fate of Dustin Holloman and not tell them?
I don't know, she whispered. That poor little boy,
Phoebe squeaked behind her hands.
The best thing we can do for him is our jobs, Ellen said, fighting to push away the mental fatigue and uncertainty.
Cameron, I want you to write the best damn brief in history on exigent circumstances and probable cause regarding the Fourth Amendment. We're not letting Wright weasel out of this on a technicality.
You got it.
I also want you to ride herd on Agent Wilhelm. Keep after him about digging into Wright's background. He should have a man on it full time. If they can't catch Wright's accomplice, then his past is our way in.
I'll make some phone calls.
He slid into his chair and started making notes. Phoebe, it's your job to run interference. Ellen caught one of the girl's wrists and gently pulled her hand away from her damp face.
Are you listening to me?
Yes.
I know you're used to giving the defense attorneys free access to files and information. We've always had an open door policy. You're going to slam that door shut in Tony Costello's face. If he wants something from this office, he has to request it in writing. Make this as inconvenient for him as possible. I'm never in when he calls. He never gets in to see me without an appointment. Understand?
Phoebe nodded, bouncing her glasses down out of her hair. She shoved them into place, sniffed, and sat up straighter, putting on her bravest face to accept her duty.
Now, turn that television up, Ellen ordered, nodding to the portable set they had perched on a file cabinet. The Channel 11 news camera was homing in on Costello's handsome face. In the words of Sheriff Steiger, let's see what shit he's throwing at the wall now.
An innocent man is free, Costello began. A cheer went up from the students gathered on the sidewalk behind the press. Upon reviewing the circumstances and the facts of this case, Judge Grabko has seen fit to grant Dr. Wright bail and reverse the earlier injustice imposed by the prosecution and the late Judge Franken. The afternoon was growing dark, with the promise of night and more snow. Portable lights had been set on the steps of the courthouse to illuminate the players in this melodrama. The cameraman was positioned down the steps, shooting up. The effect was dramatic, with the pillars of the courthouse as a backdrop. Costello looked powerful, his shoulders filling the screen in close-ups, his face as masculine and classic as a Roman sculpture. Garrett Wright stood beside him like a pale shadow, the contrast in their builds and coloring giving him an image of delicacy and refinement. Hannah stared at him as the camera pulled in close on his face. She watched the press conference on the kitchen television that sat tucked back into a corner on the counter. The ingredients for lasagna were scattered around it. In the family room, Lily was dancing to a tune from the Talking Candlestick in Beauty and the Beast. Josh ignored the video, sitting on a stool in front of the picture window, staring out at the lake. He had taken to carrying his backpack around the house with him, as if he felt a need to keep essential items with him in case he was taken away again. The backpack sat on the floor beside his stool, purple and teal and plump with who knew what. "Dr. Garrett Wright is an innocent man," Costello said. "The presumption of innocence is his constitutional right." "And what about our rights?" Hannah murmured, glaring at the television. Ellen North had called to break the news about the reduced bail. Not only had the new judge reduced the amount of the bail, he had given Wright the option of securing a bond, which meant he had to come up with only 10% of the actual amount. For $10,000, Garrett Wright could walk out of jail. No amount of money could free Josh from the prison in which Wright had locked his mind. "The investigation of Josh Kirkwood's kidnapping was mishandled from the first," Costello went on, "and right up to the arrest of Dr. Wright, who had never been considered a suspect. He had never been questioned. He had, in fact, offered assistance and had been consulted for his expertise. He was never a suspect."
"How do you explain Dr. Wright's capture?" shouted a reporter off-screen.
Costello fixed him with an eagle eye.
"Dr. Wright was not captured. He was attacked. In his own garage, on his own property. That's the truth of this situation. The Deer Lake Police Department was desperate to make an arrest. Chief Holt lost sight of his suspect during the chase Saturday night, and he grabbed the first person he could. He couldn't let that opportunity slip by when he had already had one suspect die in custody. He needed to arrest somebody, and Dr. Wright was handy. But the fact of the matter is, there is a more viable suspect who remains at large. The kidnapping of Dustin Holloman has proved that."
"What about the theory of an accomplice?"
Costello looked disgusted.
"Dr. Wright doesn't have accomplices. Dr. Wright has colleagues and students and friends."
Another cheer went up from the assembled fans. Fury boiled up inside Hannah, and she stabbed the power button on the set. Costello froze mid-word, then the tube seemed to suck his image inside it, leaving only blankness. She knew the attorney was only doing his job. She knew it was up to the prosecution to prove Garrett Wright's guilt. But it made her sick and angry to see Wright portrayed as a victim. Josh was the victim. Their family had been victimized, their lives torn apart. She didn't for a second believe Costello's contention that Garrett Wright had simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Costello was paid to make his client look innocent. Hannah had known Mitch Holt since the day he and his daughter had moved to Deer Lake, 2 years before. Mitch couldn't be bought. If Mitch said Garrett Wright was the man, Garrett Wright was the man. On the night of the arrest, Mitch had come to the house, wounded and exhausted, and explained every detail of the chase and capture. She replayed the scene in her mind as she went through the motions of preparing supper for her children, her hands shaking so badly she spilled tomato sauce on the counter. It splashed across the tile like blood, the color of violence and rage. For a long moment, she just stood there staring at it. She thought of Megan O'Malley, beaten, the lifeblood of her career rushing out of her. She thought of that night Mitch had come, the night she'd told Paul it was over between them.
The last lifeblood of their marriage had been drained from them. She thought of Josh and the blood that had been drawn from his arm. Hannah didn't know if any of them could ever get back what they had lost. And yet Garrett Wright could make a down payment and buy back his freedom. If he wanted, he could come home to the house down the block. He could resume his residence in Lakeside with no regard for the lives he had wrecked at the end of the street. It seemed he could wipe the slate of his conscience clean as easily as she wiped away the spilled sauce on the counter. No consequences. Clean up the mess and forget about it. He won't get away with it. Ellen had assured her the county attorney's office was working diligently to bring the case to trial and to convict Garrett Wright. Mitch had told her all the law enforcement agencies involved in the Dustin Holloman case were focused on capturing Wright's accomplice. She had to trust the system. She believed in it. Believed it worked more often than not. She had to believe in justice. He won't get away with it. She slid the lasagna into the oven, wiped her hands on a dish towel, and walked down into the family room. The movie was still rolling, but no one seemed to be watching it. Lily was singing a tune of her own composition, and her own language, and wiggling around the cherry trunk that served as coffee table. She had pulled a pair of huge pink play sunglasses out of the toy box and wore them at a jaunty angle. Hannah grabbed a discarded baseball cap and plunked it sideways on her daughter's head, finding a smile that had become too rare in the last weeks. "Hey, Lily Bug, are you doing the diaper dance?" she asked, squatting down and wiggling her own behind, sending Lily into a giggling frenzy. Hannah laughed, amazed at how good that felt. Then her gaze strayed to Josh, and the laughter died. He hadn't moved from the window. His expression hadn't changed. He didn't seem to be with them. His emotional isolation took on magical physical properties, an invisible force field around him that didn't allow him to see or hear or reach out to the people who loved him. The idea came with a swift needle stab of pain. A force field was something Josh would have created a story around before. He was fascinated by science fiction, loved to make up his own tales after watching Star Trek: The Next Generation. Since fall, he had carried a notebook with him everywhere. His ThinkPad, he called it, to draw pictures of rocket ships and race cars. He had filled the pages with his thoughts and ideas. The notebook was gone now, given over to the state crime lab. The kidnapper had used it as one of his taunts, placing it on the hood of Mitch Holt's truck. Another piece of Josh's childhood gone. Even as she thought it, Hannah's gaze caught on the sketch pad the county child advocate had given Josh. It lay on the floor, pushed aside, unused, blank. She shivered at the thought that Josh's mind might be that blank. There was no way of knowing as long as he chose not to share his feelings. He had spent another 50 minutes with a psychiatrist that afternoon, staring at the woman's aquarium, watching the fish swim back and forth. His only comment had come at the end of the session. He had turned to Dr. Freeman and said, "They're trapped, aren't they? They can see out, but they can never get out." As he sat staring out the window, Hannah couldn't help but wonder if he felt the same way. On impulse, she turned away from him and went back through the kitchen to Paul's immaculate home office. He had yet to clean out the room, though she supposed that day would come when he would box up half of their marriage and take it all away. Hannah found what she was looking for on a shelf in the closet, where Paul kept supplies, a brand new blue spiral notebook. From the organizer on the desk, she chose the most exotic-looking pen she could find, a fat red one with a fancy blue clip and a removable cap. She left the office and went into the laundry room, where one cupboard drawer held gift wrap, tape, and string and sheets of stickers. Digging through the mess, she found an assortment of stickers she knew would appeal to Josh, and used them to decorate the cover of the notebook. With a laundry marker, she carefully wrote, "Josh's new ThinkPad," across the center of the cover. Then at the very bottom printed, "To Josh, from Mom," and finished the line with a heart. He was still sitting by the window when she returned to the living room. Lily had lost all interest in the movie
and was busy dragging toys out of the toy box.
"Josh, honey," Hannah said, laying a hand on his shoulder, "I've got something for you. Will you come sit with me on the couch so I can give it to you?"
He looked up at her, away from the window and the dark view of the lake, then gathered up his backpack and went to the couch. He sat back in a corner, the pack on his lap, his arms around it as if it were a favorite old teddy bear. Hannah took the opportunity to close the drapes, though she left the stool he had been using. Sitting next to him, she resisted the urge to pull him close. Dr. Freeman had impressed upon her the need to give Josh a little breathing room, even though what she wanted most to do was hold him 24 hours a day.
"Remember your ThinkPad and how it got lost?" she asked.
Josh nodded, though his attention seemed to be caught on the baseball cap Lily had discarded on the floor.
"I remember how you used to draw and write in it all the time. All the neat pictures you used to do with spaceships and everything. And I got to thinking, you probably still miss it. I mean, that sketch pad you got is pretty cool, but it's sort of big, isn't it? You can't really carry it around. It won't fit in your backpack. And so, ta-da!" She held out the new notebook in front of him. "Josh's new ThinkPad."
Hannah held her breath as he looked at it. He made no move to take it at first, but his gaze traveled the cover from top to bottom, taking in the stickers of the Starship Enterprise and football helmets and Batman. Slowly he uncurled one arm from around his backpack and reached out with his forefinger. He touched one sticker, and then the next. He traced beneath the title, then dragged his fingertip down to the bottom of the page. "To Josh from Mom." He opened his hand and stroked the line, his expression wistful and sad.
"Go ahead, honey," Hannah whispered around the lump in her throat. "It's yours. Just for you. You can write down whatever you want in it. Stories or secrets or dreams. You don't ever have to share it with anyone if you don't want to. But if you want to share it with me, you know I'll listen. Anything you want to tell me, you can. And it'll be all right. We can work out anything. Because we love each other. Right?"
His eyes filled with tears as he looked at the notebook, and he nodded slowly, reluctantly. Hannah wished she could have known what part of her statement made him hesitate. Was it that he didn't believe he could tell her, or that he didn't believe they could work it out? She had no way of knowing. All she could do was offer him support and reassurance, and hope to God the promises she made him weren't empty. As he took the notebook from her, she pulled him close and kissed the top of his head.
"We will work it out, Josh, however long it takes. It doesn't matter," she whispered. "I'm just so happy to have you home, to be able to tell you how much I love you."
She pulled back from him a little and made a goofy face at him.
"And get mushy all over you."
A tiny smile of embarrassment hooked one corner of his mouth, and he rolled his eyes. Like the old Josh, like the boy who loved to kid with her and laugh.
"It's okay, Mom," he said in a small voice.
"It better be," Hannah joked, "'cause, you know, even when you're a grown-up and the star quarterback in the Super Bowl, I'll still be your mom, and I'll still get mushy." Josh wrinkled his nose and turned his attention back to the notebook. He ran his finger over the stickers one by one, naming each one in his head. He recognized them all from before, when he had been a regular kid, when life had been simple, and his biggest secret had been kissing Molly Higgins on the cheek. He wished he could go back to before. He didn't like secrets, didn't like the way they made him feel inside, but he had to keep them now. There could be no telling. He had been warned. So he chose not to think about the secrets at all. He would think about other things, like his new pen and how it looked like something astronauts might use, and his new ThinkPad. Blank pages, just for him, not for sharing with strangers or anyone. Blank pages that were like part of his imagination, space for thinking and storing thoughts away. He liked that idea, taking thoughts out of his head and storing them away
where he didn't have to think them anymore. He slipped the notebook into his backpack and carried it to his room. Chapter 17. Ellen pulled her glasses off and rubbed her hands over her face, unconcerned about her makeup. Her makeup was long gone. There was no one around the office to see her anyway. Even the cleaning people had come and gone. Ellen had done the reverse. She had gone to Campion and come back. At Campion, she had run the gauntlet of reporters and stood in the windswept parking lot of the grain and ag services on the edge of town, where Dustin Holloman's boot had been found in the cab of an employee's pickup. "Doesn't this confirm Dr. Wright's innocence? Will you try to delay next week's hearing? Is it true Garrett Wright was never a suspect before his arrest? Is it true Wright plans to sue for malicious prosecution? Is the owner of the pickup being questioned? Is he a suspect?" The questions came at her like lances. The reporters swarmed around her, their eyes bright and feral. The parking lot was a rough sea of ice, rutted and polished by truck tires. Under the sodium vapor security lights, it took on a pearly glow. The buildings and huge metal bins of the grain elevator made an austere backdrop, shaker plain and simply functional, unlit, unwelcoming. Clouds had taken the daylight early, and snow had begun to fall. Small, sharp flakes hurled down from heaven on a frigid, unforgiving wind. The BCA Mobile Crime Lab was parked at a cockeyed angle, 20 feet away from the lone pickup truck. Evidence technicians swarmed around the truck, working in the brilliant light of portable halogen lamps. "They're taking their time," Mitch said. "They don't want to miss so much as a hair, which is all well and good, but the guy who owns the truck raises cattle, and his dog rides around with him in the cab. They'll be here all night getting hair off the goddamn seat cover." Ellen squinted against the pelting snow and the glare of the lights. "Who owns the truck?" "Kent Hofschult. He works in the office here." "Any connection to the Hollimans?" "Casual acquaintance, I hear. You want details, you'll have to talk to Steiger." She stepped a little closer to the truck, just as an evidence tech moved aside from the open driver's door. Dustin Holloman's boot sat on the bench seat of the truck, center stage under the halogen spotlight. A single winter boot, the purple and yellow nylon of the upper portion too bright in this bleak setting. She had returned to the office because she had more cases than Garrett Wright's on her schedule. There were loose ends that needed tying, and then there were Quentin Adler's endless questions about the two cases she had handed over to him. But she had appetite for neither the work she needed to accomplish, nor the turkey sandwich she had picked up at Subway for her supper. All systems were crashing due to lack of fuel, but the thought of food turned her stomach. Out of practice. When she had worked in Minneapolis, she had got to the point where she could go from a murder scene to dinner and not think twice about it. The mind was an amazing machine, able to develop what defenses it needed, but it had been a long time since she had needed defenses. "Call it a night," she murmured, checking the clock. 9:15. Poor Harry wasn't seeing much of his mistress these days. At least, he had Otto. Otto Norvald, her neighbor and fellow dog lover, who didn't mind seeing to Harry when Ellen had to put in a late night. She sorted through the stack of files in front of her, taking those pertinent to Wright and two other cases she would have to deal with the next day, a burglary for which she expected the defendant to cop a plea, and a DUI she fully intended to put in jail for as long as she could. The files went into her briefcase. Then she set about her daily ritual of arranging everything left on her desk in precise order. She had learned long ago that her office was the one place in her professional life where she could always be guaranteed order and control. She exercised the ritual with religious dedication and found it much more calming than the pointless raking of a Zen garden. Satisfied with the task, she pushed her chair into its cubbyhole, dug in her coat pockets for her gloves. Her mind was already halfway out the building, wondering how much snow had fallen in the 2 hours since she had come back. 4 to 6 inches was predicted. The road back from Campion had already begun to drift over in spots. She dug her keys out of her purse, slung the bag over her shoulder, and started for the door just as the telephone rang. "What now?" she muttered on a groan, fearing the worst
behind the screen of annoyance. "Ellen North," she said into the receiver. Nothing. "Hello?" It was Monday night, all over again. The heavy sense of a presence on the other end of the line, a silence that seemed ominous. Her stomach churned as the line from last night's call played through the back of her mind. "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." "If you've got something to say, then say it," she snapped. "I've got better things to do with my time." A breath. Soft and long. It seemed to come out of the receiver and curl around her throat like a snake. "Ellen." The whisper was little more than a thought. Androgynous. As thin as gauze. "Who is this?" "Working late, Ellen." She slammed the receiver down. Mitch had set up a caller ID tracer on her home telephone, but there was nothing on the office phones, and she questioned the legality of installing anything. The call had come in on her direct line, a number that was not listed in any public directory. Did that mean the caller was someone she knew, or someone who had been in her office without her knowledge? Business hours were long over. Had the caller caught her here by chance, or was he aware hers was the only office light on in the building? "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." "Working late, Ellen?" She cast a glance at her window. Even with the blinds drawn, the light would be visible from outside. Lifting the blinds away from the glass at one side, she tried to peer out, but there was nothing to see except the weird mix of night and swirling snow. "Your boss needs to have a word with someone about security. This is a highly volatile case you've got here. Anything might happen." "Ellen, you're a likely target." "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." The blinds clattered back against the window glass. Ellen grabbed up the receiver and punched the number for the sheriff's department in the adjacent building. For 2 years, she had worked in this building without fear. She had never felt a need for a security guard, had never turned a hair walking the halls alone at night. That sense of calm was one of the things she had come here looking for. In Deer Lake, she could walk her dog along the lake at night. She could leave her bedroom window open and go to sleep with a cool fall breeze caressing her face. Now, she was calling for a sheriff's deputy to escort her to her car. The deputy who appeared at the office door 5 minutes later was Ed Quayle. Pushing 60, he was lean and sinewy, with a pewter-gray flat top and piercing blue eyes. He had testified in court for Ellen from time to time, a good, solid cop. "I hope I didn't pull you away from anything too important," she said, as they headed together down the dimly lit hall. Quayle shook his head. "Nah, accident reports is all. Nothing much more than fender benders going on around here tonight. I'm on light duty anyway, banged up a knee playing hockey. I guess all the action tonight was over in Campion, huh?" "Well, I don't blame you for wanting a walk to your car. Everyone's a little edgy these days. A person just don't know what to expect anymore." "I used to have a motto," Ellen said. "Expect the worst, hope for the best." Quayle frowned as they started down the stairs. "We're sure getting more of the one than the other lately. You parked on the side?" "Yes." They cut across the rotunda, the sound of their footfalls soaring up 3 stories. A sharp crack rang down one of the dark corridors, and Ellen flinched, then scolded herself. The building had a century's worth of creaks and groans. "Too bad about Denny Enberg," Quayle said. "He was a decent sort for a defense attorney. Everyone says it looked like suicide." "Looked like. We'll see what the ME has to say." Quayle hummed a non-committal note. It struck Ellen that people would have much preferred Dennis to have stuck a gun in his mouth and ended his own life, as terrible as that would have been. They would rather he had been so crushed by the weight of his problems that he saw no other way out, because then the madness was contained to one man. Something to lament, but not contagious. The alternative was vulnerability, and no one wanted any part of that.
Ellen's Bonneville was the only car on the courthouse lot. 60 yards in the other direction, adjacent to the sheriff's department and county jail, a dozen or so vehicles were clustered together like a herd of horses, snow mounting on their backs. The wind swept in from the northwest, wrapping itself around the contours of the buildings, creating small powdery white cyclones that skittered across the unplowed parking lot. The sidewalk had disappeared. Streetlights took on the hazy glow of tiny moons. The streets themselves were all but deserted. Residents had chosen to hole up for the evening, to wait for the 10 o'clock news, and the predictions for the morning commute to work and school. "Thanks, Ed," Ellen said, waving him off as they neared the car. "No problem. Stay warm." Hunching his shoulders, he started up the slight grade toward the sheriff's department entrance. Ellen hit the button on her remote that unlocked her car doors and brought the interior lights on. Her gaze swept the area, seeing it in a far more critical light than she had when she had parked here in Rudy's personal spot 2 hours ago. The spot that was close to the building, that had looked so handy, that shortened her walk through the weather, now struck her as a stupid choice. Better to have parked in the second row, away from the building, where shadows and shrubbery could offer cover, and under a security light. Still, no deadly figure darted out of the darkness along the building. She had almost begun to relax as she rounded the trunk and came up along the driver's side of the Bonneville. The momentary letdown made the instant burst of fear seem all the more extreme. A gasp caught in her throat as she jumped back, the deep, new snow grabbing at her boots like chilled quicksand. Scratched into the paint of the driver's side door in large, irregular letters was a single ugly word. Bitch. Chapter 18. The weapon of choice was a switchblade knife, conveniently left behind, plunged to its hilt in the left front tire.
"There won't be no patching that," Officer Dietz said.
Lonnie Dietz was 50, a decent officer with a bad Mo Howard toupee, which was covered tonight by a towering fake fur hat that made him look as if he had a pack of weasels nesting on his head.
"You got a spare?"
"Just that little donut thing," Ellen said, hugging herself, her eyes on the knife.
"The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." "You have any ideas who might have done this, Ms. North?"
Officer Noga asked. Noogie Noga was roughly the size of a grizzly bear. A native of Samoa, he had come to Minnesota on a football scholarship and stayed even after a bum knee had ended his NFL hopes. Ellen shrugged.
"Specifically? No, but I've been getting some odd phone calls."
"Related to the Wright case?"
She nodded.
"I just got another one before I came down. That's why I had Ed here walk me down."
"What did the caller say?"
Noga asked, pencil poised against his notepad.
"For a long time there was nothing. Then he said my name, asked if I was working late."
The three cops looked at one another blankly, and frustration knotted in Ellen's chest. She couldn't blame them for thinking she was overreacting. Stated flatly, the call lost all its darker, disturbing qualities. "The call that came last night after 2 in the morning said, 'Let's kill all the lawyers,'" she added, hugging herself a little tighter. She felt as if she were being split in two, half of her the cool professional, the other half a panicking creature.
"She-ute,"
Noga muttered, as the import hit. Everyone on the job had heard the gruesome details of Dennis Enberg's death.
"But you don't have any idea who's making these calls?" Dietz asked.
"I can't recognize the voice. It's too soft, indistinct. I'm not even sure if it's a man or a woman."
"And no one's threatened you outright?" Quayle asked.
"There are plenty of people unhappy with me for prosecuting Garrett Wright, but none of them have made an overt threat to my face."
She listed the names for Noga, the faces floating through her head like puzzle pieces. Wright was out on bail, but he would never risk such a foolish gesture himself, and she doubted Costello had let him out of his sight. Then there was Todd Childs and Christopher Priest, Karen Wright, Paul Kirkwood, who blamed her for Grabko's decision on bail, the students who had taken up Wright's cause on the picket line in front of the courthouse.
Her confrontation with the sci-fi cowboys came most vividly to mind.
Hey, you that bitch lawyer.
Bitch lawyer. Bitch. She could see Tyrell's angry face, eyes seething with hate. She didn't want to blame the cowboys out of hand. The whole point of the program was to show that these young men had the potential to be productive citizens. But she had worked in the system and knew too well the destruction and violence these kids were capable of. She had seen too many with no conscience and no respect for anyone or anything.
The program has sure got a lot of press, Quayle said.
Deet sniffed and spit a gob into the snow.
I don't care what anyone says, they're a bunch of city punks. Did you see them out here today with that damn rap music cranked up? We don't need their kind of trouble. If I want to fear for my life walking around town, I'll go up to Minneapolis and take a stroll down Lake Street after dark.
We'll check it out, Ms. North, Noga said. See what we can come up with on any of those people.
He crouched down and snapped a couple of Polaroids of the damage, slipping the undeveloped photographs inside his parka. Ellen stared at the word gouged on her car door. An angry scrawl, written with a blade deadly enough to kill. The knife handle thrusting up from the tire was like a misplaced exclamation point. She shivered at the thought of what might have happened had she come out of the building alone and surprised the vandal at work.
You'll have to have someone take care of that tire, Deet said. Won't happen tonight. You want to ride home?
I'll take her, officer.
Ellen jerked around at the sound of the voice. Brooks stood behind her, his shoulders hunched, coat collar pulled up high. He squinted against the wind and the cold and her scrutiny.
What are you doing here?
The annoyance in her tone didn't stop Jay from asking himself the same question. He had notes to go over and sort, and phone calls to make to pry into the past lives of Garrett Wright and his disciple Todd Childs, and he sure as hell would rather have been in his rented house making use of the fireplace tools he had picked up that afternoon than standing out in a snowstorm. But here he was.
I heard the call on the scanner, he said.
And a chill had gone through him. He tried to tell himself it was adrenaline, the excitement of a new lead, a fresh angle. Then he tried to put it off to the fact that he hadn't gotten warm since he'd stepped off the plane into the Great White North. Then he thought of Ellen, fighting a battle because she believed in the cause, standing up beneath the burden of it with grace and courage. Ellen, alone, victimized for doing her job. Not that she wanted him there. She looked at him askance. And you didn't have anything better to do than check out a simple vandalism? He cast a pointed look at the knife handle jutting up from her tire.
Doesn't look so simple to me, counselor.
Her peak couldn't quite hide the glimmer of fear in her eyes as her glance stayed on the knife. Her lack of a snappy comeback told the rest of the truth. She was scared, plain and simple. She could more than hold her own in a verbal sword fight, but when the hardware was the real deal, that was a whole different ballgame. Noga looked from Ellen to Jay and back.
Ms. North?
Ellen's knees had gone wobbly as she stared at the knife.
The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
Dennis Enberg's body, his head shattered like a rotten melon.
The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
Garrett Wright walking free. Dustin Holloman's little boot left to taunt them.
Bitch. Bitch. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
Come on, Brooke said, stepping close enough to slide an arm around her shoulders buddy style.
Let's go get some hot coffee in you.
That sounds good, Ellen heard herself say, the professional still attempting to function, still pretending she could handle all of this madness at once.
We'll finish up here, Ms. North, Noga said. We'll call you as soon as we have anything.
He turned to Jay with a shy smile and stuck out his hand.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Brooks. I really enjoy your work. Well, thank you, Officer Noga. I'll tell you what, it's always gratifying to hear that from people in law enforcement.
What Ellen thought of as his public face beamed with a big old country boy grin. She imagined she could actually feel the level of energy in and around him increase by 1,000 volts. It was a wonder the snow didn't melt beneath his feet. Amazing. Dietz jumped in, thrusting out his report notebook.
Would you mind an autograph? Twist of Fate was my favorite.
Thank you. Hear that, Ellen? He said as he scribbled his name across the paper. These gentlemen actually enjoy what I do.
There's no accounting for tastes, she grumbled.
Come along, Ms. North,
Brooke said, resting a big gloved hand on her shoulder.
I know just the place to warm you up.
He gave her a roguish look as they waded through the snow toward his Cherokee.
Note what a gentleman I'm being. I could have said I'm just the man for the job.
You just did.
And, true as it might be, I am much too well brought up to take advantage of a vulnerable woman.
Yeah, right. Ellen stiffened against another attack of shakes. She needed to focus. She focused on Brooks, tried to stir up irritation to warm her and center her thoughts. I'd bet my last dime you would take advantage of your own mother if it meant getting the story you want.
That wounds me, Ellen. Here I am, rescuing you in your hour of need, and you impugn my motives.
You've made your motives very clear, she said as he handed her up into the passenger side of the truck. And I quote, I'm here for a story. I go after what I want, and I get it.
Excellent memory. People must have hated you in law school.
He stamped back around the hood of the truck and climbed in on the driver's side.
You know, where I come from, folks at least pretend gratitude, even if they are truly unappreciative.
I didn't need rescuing, Ellen said. I'm perfectly capable of taking care of myself.
Oh, you fend off knife-wielding maniacs every day, do you?
I didn't have to fend off anyone.
Yeah, well, the night is young, he growled.
He put the Cherokee in gear and did a slow U-turn to get out of the lot. The truck's heater was on full blast. The wipers beat furiously at the snow hurtling down. The street was a broad ribbon of white, corrugated with tire tracks. A nice night to curl up by the fire with a good book and a cup of hot chocolate, Ellen thought, as she looked out the window, wishing she could do just that, knowing that she would have been doing just that if not for Garrett Wright and his faceless partner. Instead, she would have another night of preparation for the battle with Costello, another night of trying to piece together the facts to come up with some kind of theory as to why a man like Garrett Wright would steal a child and hold a community in the grip of fear. Another night of sifting through the growing haystack of information, searching for a clue as to who Wright's accomplice might be, as to who her tormentor might be. Were they one and the same? Had they killed Denny Enberg? Would they try to kill her?
Bitch. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
She felt as if she were fighting battles on all fronts at once, as if she were surrounded. She put her back to the door and faced her unlikely rescuer. Where are we going?
Someplace quiet. Out of the way. Homey. Your place, actually.
He glanced at her, studying her in the gloom of the instrument panel.
I'd take you to my place, but guests tend to be put off by a total lack of furniture.
Where are you staying?
I rented a house out on Ryan's Bay.
Ryan's Bay? That's where Josh's jacket was found.
A macabre coincidence, he assured her. Honest.
I'm sure you're probably guilty of many things, Mr. Brooks, but I think we're safe in eliminating you from the list of possible accomplices.
You have a list?
Figure of speech.
You have theories, he murmured. I have a couple of my own.
He gunned the engine, plowing up the incline of her driveway. Thank you for the ride, Ellen said politely, her gaze fixed on the dark house, fear swelling inside her at the thought of going in alone. But she let herself out of the truck before Brooks made it around the hood. I'm not helpless, she insisted, as he pulled her keys out of her hand. she twisted away from him when he would have taken her briefcase from her.
No, you're not helpless. You're a damn target, he grumbled, stomping through the snow to the front door. Your buddy Enberg is lying on a slab tonight, shorter by a head. Somebody uses your car for an etch-a-sketch and leaves you a switchblade. If you think I'm letting you walk into this house alone, you are dead wrong. Pardon the expression.
And who appointed you to the role of guardian? Ellen demanded, walking into the foyer and towing off her boots.
Nobody.